against Black, Hazenmeal, Liebsker, and Moore. Mr. Hettinger.
May it please the Court. My name is Steve Hettinger. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this Fair Debt Collection Practices Act appeal. We've raised two issues in our appeal, but in the interest of time, I will focus my remarks on the 1692F issue concerning the unfair or unconscionable actions. If the Court desires, however, I'd be happy to discuss the 1692E issue as well. My client, Ella Beeler, is retired. She's disabled. She receives Social Security payments about the second or third day of each month. The defendant, the appellee in this case, Blatt Hassen Miller, is a law firm hired by a judgment creditor that Blatt took a judgment against Ella back in March of 2004 for about $731 and then commenced collection activities. The 1692E claim concerns the complaint filed in the circuit court for collection, and the 1692F claim concerns the collection activities. Those, in turn, concern exemptions, both allowed under federal and state law. Those Social Security payments that Ella received are exempt from any collection under both 42 U.S.C. 407 and under the Illinois exemption statute. There are other exemptions that apply as well.
Does this exemption last, in your view? Underlying this claim, before you even get to this claim of unconscionability, appears to be your claim that any proceeds traceable to Social Security benefits are forever exempt from collection. What's the basis of that?
I believe there's case law directly on that point, Your Honor, and the issue never came up, and off the top of my head, I don't remember.
I understand that defendant has forfeited any argument on this issue.
Well, I believe it's a Philpott case, though, Judge.
Puzzle to me. I mean, suppose you get $2,000 from Social Security and use it to buy a car and pledge the car as security for the loan. In your view, is it impossible for the auto dealer to foreclose on that security because the car is attributable to Social Security benefits?
I believe the Illinois exemption statute does speak directly
Let's
to that.
Let's talk about the federal statute, because that's what you initially relied on, and that's the statute interpreted in the Fifth Circuit case that you cite to us.
That's true, Your Honor. I believe the Philpott case does say that, and its progeny does say that the proceeds from Social Security remain exempt, but I truthfully have not drawn that out to see how far they remain exempt. I don't know the answer to your hypothetical. It may be that after, under the federal law, after an item is purchased with those proceeds, that it loses its exemption. There is an Illinois case directly on point that said, no, it doesn't. In that case, and that's the Fayette County Hospital case, the court said, and it was interpreting Section 407 and applying Section 407. That was before the Illinois statute was amended.
It sounds like, I mean, if you think this extends past the day of receipt, it sounds like an argument that older people or anybody receiving Social Security benefits can never get credit because it will never be possible to collect what they buy, and therefore no sane creditor would extend credit to anybody who's eligible for Social Security benefits. Now, I can't believe that that's what the system is.
Well, I believe it is, though, Your Honor, and I think there are the cases where that very thing has happened.
You think it would help older people to have a legal rule that says, as a matter of law, people past the age of 62 never have to pay any of their debts, and therefore, obviously, the market reaction is none of them will ever be able to get any credit?
Well, I'm not aware of that as being a problem, Your Honor. The exemptions are pretty well known and widespread.
One reason why it might not be a problem is because your view of the exemption may be wrong.
I believe the case law speaks in my favor on that, though, Your Honor.
But, you know, there's another point here, which is that maybe some people are going to be like your client, and let's assume for the sake of simplicity, I know there's some evidence to the contrary, that every penny in her bank account is exempt. But a lot of people are going to use Social Security payments, whether it's SSI or whether it's more likely the retirement payments, as a supplement to income, which leads to my question. The responsibility for identifying what's exempt has to be placed somewhere. It can be placed on the individual receiving those benefits. It can be placed on the bank that perhaps gets direct deposits from the federal government. It could be placed on the debt collector. But it has to be somewhere. And it seems to me logical that the person in the best position to know what's exempt and what isn't exempt is actually the recipient of the funds, you know, Mrs. Beeler in this instance. And so it wouldn't startle me to see both federal law and Illinois law recognizing that there are going to be things you can criticize with any allocation of responsibility, saying, well, we think it's best to put that responsibility on the recipient of the benefits slash bank account holder. We're going to give this person an opportunity to come in and say, you've made a mistake, you've frozen too much, but we, you know, you have to do something. You can't just sort of say no one has that responsibility.
Well, I think, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, that the statute is very clear that that responsibility does fall on the debtor, the judgment debtor, in this case, Mrs. Beeler. And I don't think it is in anybody else's hands except for the trial judge, who gets to rule on any objections to exemptions.
And so why didn't, I mean, I realize that your point about the economics of it, but why didn't the system work pretty well? The bank gets the citation to discover assets, it freezes everything, she goes in, says it's exempt income, they drop the claim, and it's unfrozen.
I think it's the progression of the statute, Your Honor.
So you agree that this is, I don't know what the problem is then, because that's
the problem is
here.
They didn't follow the statute. The statute does not permit the statute only allows the freeze to apply to exempt non-exempt assets. There's only one way to determine what is exempt and isn't exempt, and that is to have a citation hearing. It doesn't have to be held in every citation hearing. The Supreme Court Rule 277 specifically contemplates both contemporaneous and consecutive citations.
So, but your point then is that it's an unconscionable method of collecting a debt if you ask simultaneously for a freeze. You have to have some window in there before the freeze takes effect during which the debtor can come in and say, so much in my account, whether it's $900 or whether it's whatever,
I believe that's
exempt.
Absolutely, because...
But is there a regulation or anything that says that, 10 business days or anything?
As the amount of time for what, Your Honor?
Well, you're saying you have to serve the citation first with no demand for a freeze. Then you have to have a hearing to find out, or you have to have some opportunity for the person whose assets are at risk of being frozen to come in and say, I'm alerting you to what's exempt. This is it sounds to me like the stuff of regulations that you're asking for.
Well, there are no regulations, and the Code of Civil Procedure does address that. There's a five-day, the hearing cannot be held any sooner than 5 days after the debtor is notified of the service of the citation. It can be held as late as 6 months later, which is the Rule 277 cutoff time for any citation. But I think more to the point, Your Honor, the statute would contemplate, and Illinois could have created a different scheme, but this is a scheme they created, which says that until you know what is exempt and non-exempt, you have no business freezing anything. The exemptions, after all, include more than just Social Security or retirement or other things that may be easily traceable. There's the wildcard exemption that's completely up to the debtor to decide, I want to reserve this $2,000 in this asset. And until the debtor does that, anyone, any freeze would automatically violate Section 1402, which says only non-exempt assets. I'm in my reserve time, and so I'll speak more after Mr. Hartzell. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Hartzell.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to start by following up on Judge Wood's question, which was about where does the responsibility lie for determining what assets are exempt.
But I understood your opponent to concede that it lies on the debtor, and his particular focus is on, I mean, he didn't quite put it this way, but as I see it, is on Rider A, which, if looked at the way, you know, at least if looked at the way the bank looked at it, didn't require anything in terms of determining whether there were exempt assets or not. You gave her absolutely no time. And the question under 1692F is whether you're using a method to collect or attempt to collect the debt that's unfair or unconscionable. And maybe having a simultaneous Rider A is such a method.
Well,
granting that it's her responsibility to come in and say, here's what's exempt, here's what isn't.
It is the court. Ultimately, it is the circuit court's responsibility to determine.
No, but you are using a method that deprives somebody of every last cent, puts them out in the street, you know, with a cup for 3 weeks because you've frozen every penny they own.
Well, I'm not sure it's that dramatic, but the code.
She claims it was.
Well, actually, the record evidence here is that there were all kinds of miscellaneous deposits going into this account, some as much as $400.
But not that month. She claims that all of her bank account was frozen that month, and your method is one which, by having an absolute zero period of time to find out if there's anything exempt in a bank account, that's a method that leads to this possibility. And I would add the other thing about your method is that it is the allegation in any event of actual knowledge. Maybe sometimes that's a reasonable method, but if you had actual knowledge that even a dollar in the account was exempt income, then you couldn't ask the bank to freeze the whole thing. You would have had to say, let's keep the dollar out.
We didn't ask the bank to freeze the whole thing. We asked the bank to freeze non-exempt assets.
That depends how you read Rider A. I looked at Rider A. I'm not sure that that's so clear.
And I would also submit, Judge, that it's not our procedure. It is the procedure that the Illinois legislature has set forth in the Illinois Code.
What? They don't put Rider A in the Illinois Code.
What they put in there at Section 14.02F1 is a provision that says that the citation, which is the process by which you initiate the supplemental proceedings.
Well, I'm going to read the first line of Rider A, or Exhibit A. The rider says, upon receipt of this citation to discover assets, please do the following, :1, freeze all assets of the defendant in your control pursuant to the direction, the citation, up to twice the amount of judgment plus judgment interest. It doesn't say freeze non-exempt assets.
It says pursuant to the direction of the citation, which specifically refers to non-exempt assets.
If you get that far, but a bank reading this could read freeze all assets of the defendant in your control, and according to evidence proffered in this record, that's what they all do.
Well, what the bank did in this case is they filed a response to the citation, a form response which has references to checking account, savings account, and paren amount withheld. I believe the bank knew exactly how to respond to this.
Well, I'm just saying this says checking and or now account amount withheld $990.13, page A9. It doesn't say anything about any effort to find out if anything is exempt. And when it's simultaneous like this, the debtor has no opportunity at the same nanosecond that the bank gets this citation to come in and say, these are exempt assets.
This is the balance that the Illinois legislature
decided. I'm not sure they
upon.
Did. I think it's the balance you found. Well, and the Illinois legislature may or may not have permitted it. The federal law may or may not have permitted it. But certainly I don't see anything in Illinois law that requires this method of proceeding.
It doesn't require it. It allows it. It specifically allows.
Well, then it's not the system the Illinois law set up. It's a system you devised within what you thought the range of both federal and Illinois law.
Well, again, we didn't devise it. We're following the provisions in the Illinois Code.
You're not. You are. If the Illinois Code is open, then you have made a judgment about what you can do within that open ground. You just agreed that Illinois law doesn't require this. There's no appendix of forms, you know, in the Illinois law that says here's rider, the rider that you must use.
Well, I think the fact that there's a rider attached to it is really beside the point.
No, it's not. The rider is what says freeze all assets of the defendant in your control.
Pursuant to the direction of the citation, which
pursuant
specifically
to
refers
to the direction, the citation actually is what it says. It doesn't even
which
say
specifically all. Limits it to non-exempt assets. And the statute, the code 1402, provides one: you initiate a supplemental proceeding by issuing a citation. Two. At Section F, the citation may prohibit.
I'm not sure, counsel, why you care about the answer to this question. And the premise of this litigation appears to be that federal law creates a remedy through the FDCPA for all procedures that are inappropriate under state law. Do you concede that that's so? And let's suppose this is an inappropriate procedure under state law. Why is federal law a way to enforce state law rather than asking the state court to enforce state law?
I actually find that I find that premise very troubling, that exact point, because what it does is it turns every procedural violation or every discovery violation in the circuit court into an FDCPA action, which then is brought simultaneously over in the federal court and turns the district court judge into the adjudicator of the small claims case. For example,
so why isn't the question here whether this is, as Section 1692F provides, that you can't do, is it or is it not an unfair or unconscionable method to collect or attempt to collect a debt? That's the federal law standard.
One would suppose it's unfair or unconscionable whether or not state law allows it or prohibits it or likes it or dislikes it.
Well, I'm not sure it can be unfair or unconscionable if we are following the procedure.
But it is a matter of federal law. If state law says the way you collect a debt is to hold the debtor over a large pot of boiling oil and threaten to throw him in unless he does something, that might be unconscionable as a matter of federal law, right? Even if in the state of despair, that's the normal way of collecting a debt. If, on the other hand, we're in the state of nirvana, where the only way you can collect a debt is to go down on your knees and plead with the debtor to pay, the fact that you have gone down on one knee rather than two knees would not make it unconscionable and violate federal law.
What I would submit is that if you are following a procedure, whether it be a discovery procedure or a supplemental procedure, or whatever kind of procedure that's laid out by the Illinois Supreme Court rules or the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure, and you're following that procedure, if it turns out that you have somehow violated that procedure, you've propounded discovery.
No, you want a one-way street. You want it to be perfectly okay if you do follow state law, but not necessarily bad if you don't follow state law. And I don't see where the one-way, as Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical suggests, one or the other. State law is either beside the point and we're focusing on 1692F and what you did, or state law provides, and federal law sometimes borrows state law standards. You could make that argument if you wanted to. Say, well, 1692F, you know, borrows the standards from whatever state the debt collector happens to be in. I'm not familiar with any law that says that, but it's in general something that sometimes happens.
Well, I don't believe that every procedural violation in the state court becomes ipso facto an FDCPA violation. The example I was going to give, if I propound discovery in small claims court without leave of court, I have violated the Illinois Supreme Court rules.
I understand your point.
You were
starting to say, though, that if state law says it's okay, then it can't possibly be unfair or unconscionable. That's the part I was worried about.
That can't be right. If federal remedy is independent, it's independent.
Well, then in effect, then you may find yourselves in a situation where this court is in effect declaring that the
state procedure. We're interpreting a federal statute at that point. We're interpreting a statute to see what counts for federal law purposes.
It's a federal statute with a vague term in it. Now, of course, the usual way vague terms in federal statutes are dealt with is for agencies to promulgate regulations. It's not to turn the vague term in the federal law into a means of enforcing state law.
Well, I submit that that's exactly, though, what's happening here and is happening in a lot of cases. I mean, we routinely get collection cases where every mishap in the collection case results in an FDCPA complaint being filed, sometimes simultaneously while the collection case is proceeding. If there's a discovery violation in the collection case, does that become an FDCPA claim that I can run over here?
Counsel, have you invoked res judicata in any of these cases? You certainly didn't hear, but the first question I had is why this is a subject of independent litigation rather than a claim that had to be made in the state litigation where the error was supposedly made.
Well, in fact, it was not. When Ms. Beeler filed...
You may be unaware. You evidently are unaware that we've already held that claims of this kind must be pursued in the underlying state litigation and are barred by res judicata. But it's an affirmative defense, so it's too late for you.
Well, she did not raise it in front of the state court. In fact, the motion to quash that they filed, they directed it at the bank. I'm sorry?
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Hettinger?
Briefly, thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Hartzell argued that the bank knew what it was doing. The bank was somehow in a position to have determined what the exemptions were and to have applied those. But I would point out two things. First, the statute doesn't say that. The statute says nothing about the third party having to be in a position to divine what exemptions may apply. But second, and kind of more importantly, the notice that was served on the bank, the notice that is required by the state law, says that it's the debtor who will establish those exemptions, and it says that that will happen at the citation hearing. So if what the bank has holding in its hands says there will be, or the debtor has a right to identify exemptions, but those exemptions won't be identified until we go into court. In this case, that was 3 weeks later when the citation hearing was to be held. I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.